You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we normally bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, though, we're talking about politics, sort of. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance is now the Republican nominee for vice president. And one of the reasons Trump may have chosen Vance is his connection to Silicon Valley. Billionaire venture capitalist Peter Thiel bankrolled Vance's Senate primary in 2022. The two men go way back. And now other Silicon Valley heavyweights like Elon Musk are lining up behind the Trump-Vance ticket. New York Times technology reporter Ryan Mack has chronicled the ties between Vance and Silicon Valley in his recent article, How a Network of Tech Billionaires Helped J.D. Vance Leap into Power. He also has a book on Elon Musk coming out this fall. Welcome to All Sides, Ryan. Oh, I think you might be muted.
Oh, apologies. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So, J.D. Vance has talked about hearing tech investor Peter Thiel speak at Yale when he was in law school there, and that in his remarks, Thiel criticized the competitive nature of professions like law, saying it stifled technological innovation. Vance has described this as the most significant moment in his time at law school. How important is Thiel to the story of J.D. Vance?
So if you listen to J.D. Vance tell it, Peter Thiel is incredibly important. You know, he was on this path. You know, if you read his best-selling book, Hillbilly Elegy, to becoming a kind of big law lawyer. You know, this is someone who, you know, grew up in Appalachia or, you know, around Appalachia, and that's part of his story. You know, joined the Marines, and, you know, went to Ohio State and then Yale Law. And he tells this story while at Yale Law of coming across Peter Thiel. You know, Thiel at the time wasn't a very well-known figure. He was a venture capitalist. He had written one of the first checks into Facebook, but he wasn't a household name. And he gives this speech at Yale Law where he talks about, you know, this contrarian idea, at least in the law school of, you know, maybe you could go work at big law, or maybe you can actually go to Silicon Valley and actually enact change and push forward with change. You know, he's known for these kind of contrarian ideas, you know, for example, not going to college, for example, he preaches that. And that had a very big effect on J.D. Vance, as he tells it.
It changes the direction of his life. He ends up going out to San Francisco, going out to Silicon Valley, and trying his hand at being a venture capitalist instead of being a corporate lawyer.
Indeed, yeah. He does a bit of law for a bit, but then he gets a job in Silicon Valley at a biotech firm. And who's the person that puts in that call to get him that job? It's Peter Thiel. And so he then moves to the Bay Area in San Francisco, and, you know, that's where his tech career kind of starts.
And he bounces around to different tech firms, including Mithril Capital, I hope I'm saying that correct, which is another venture firm co-founded by Thiel. Eventually, he opens his own venture tech firm. How does that go?
Yeah, I think it's pretty key to the point with Vance is that he didn't spend much time in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. It was maybe less than 5 years. But he leaves Mithril Capital, where he works for Peter Thiel, essentially, and goes to another venture firm called Revolution. Steve Case, the AOL co-founder, started that. And he was investing in, you know, startups outside of your traditional coastal areas that attract venture capital.
Yeah, one of the things Vance has been pushing is venture capital investments in the Midwest.
Right.
Or he's trying to push it, at least.
Right. This idea that, you know, companies outside of San Francisco and New York and LA are underfunded, which is not a new thesis, but it's one that he has built his name around. You know, he spends a little bit of time at Revolution, I think about a year and a half, and then he goes and founds his own firm called Naria Capital, based in Cincinnati, that is a venture fund with the kind of same premise.
And Thiel helps him raise $120 million for that fund, correct? He's instrumental in Vance setting up his own firm.
Yes, Thiel is an investor in that firm, as well as a lot of other Silicon Valley billionaires, Marc Andreessen being one of them, Eric Schmidt being another. And so he, you know, kind of flexes those credentials when raising that fund.
And he begins backing tech platforms favored by conservatives like Parler and Rumble. These were like alternatives to like YouTube and some of the other social media sites that were trying to get off the ground. He also does try to invest in Midwestern firms like something called App Harvest, but none of them really seem to take off in the way that you might want.
Yeah, I would say actually the Parler thing he didn't actually invest in. It was something they were taking a look at, but it is this interest in these kind of, conservative alternatives to mainstream technologies. Parler is the was the conservative Twitter, and they did back Rumble, which is the YouTube alternative favored by people on the right. But yeah, AppHarvest is probably their biggest success, although it went public and then went bankrupt about 2 years after that. So,
And I do want to be clear that the nature of investing, venture capital investing, is inherently risky. People lose a lot more than they win. So I don't know that we should necessarily say how indicative that is of his success as a venture capitalist. Like, or should we? Because I know for every like Facebook, for every Google, for every Instagram, there's 1,000 other companies that never got off the ground.
sure. And that one Facebook or Instagram will pay for,
All the other
those businesses'
mistakes.
sales. Exactly. It's a betting game. But I think with Vance, the key thing to understand is, he wasn't a venture capitalist for very long. He kind of leveled up through his life. You kind of see this trend of not sticking in one place for very long. And after Narya is founded and gotten off the ground, he then goes and runs for Senate. He kind of leaves that behind. And who is there to back him for that Senate race but Peter Thiel?
Peter Thiel gives him $15 million for the primary, which is a lot of money for a primary race. It's one of the largest single donations to a primary candidate for U.S. Senate in our history. So I just want to make clear that people understand just how substantial Peter Thiel was in getting J.D. Vance off the ground in that primary. Because if, I mean, people in Ohio may remember, but we had seven, I think eight candidates in that primary. It was a clown car of a primary when Rob Portman announced he was retiring.
Yeah, there was a lot of candidates, and it wasn't clear that J.D. Vance was the front runner. Thiel sets up donuts to these PACs that support Vance. He also has a concurrent candidate in Arizona, one of his other proteges named Blake Masters, and so that's worth noting as well. He spends about $30 million on both these guys, $15 million each, and he places his bets. This is someone that wants influence and wants proximity to power in the Senate, and bets on these two guys that he's known for, about a decade or so. JD wins, Blake Masters does not win, but then he has his guy in the Senate.
Yeah, and I want to touch on that in just a second. But Thiel also helps facilitate introductions to Donald Trump, to Trump Universe, to because as anybody who knows anything about J.D. Vance knows, he had some pretty critical things to say of the former president in 2016. And so, in a lot of ways, Thiel not only bankrolls his campaign, he helps smooth things over with Donald Trump, who can be notorious for holding a grudge about the not so nice things that you say.
Yeah, I think we go back to when he was promoting his book in 2016, Hillbilly Elegy. And around that time, he calls himself a Never Trump guy. There's now these famous private messages that have been leaked about him calling Trump America's Hitler. And he had this position, as through 2016, up until 2020, and then you start to see this shift as he runs for Senate. And Peter Thiel is not just J.D. Vance's backer, but he's also a famous backer of President Trump. In 2016, he spoke at the Republican National Convention, I believe it was in Cleveland,
Yes.
gave this very rah-rah speech for then Republican nominee Trump, saying that he's going to bring a brighter future. And so this is someone who loves proximity to power, who then brokers this kind of meeting between the two, between J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is very much aware of what J.D. Vance has said about him, but Vance, I think my colleagues reported, says, let just judge me based on how I run this race, basically. And
And
that's
it
kind of the
works.
beginning of And it worked, yeah. And he gets the Trump endorsement in that 2022, Republican primary, I believe, and or
Yeah, he
I
gets it late in the
heard that,
game. He gets it
right.
a couple of weeks. He narrowly squeaks out a victory, but he does win that, and then he goes on to win the Senate seat.
Right. So this idea of leveling up again is consistent throughout his career, but and that is very, very crucial to him and where he's at now in his relationship with Donald Trump.
Yeah, and this all culminates in you write about a fundraising dinner that happens just weeks before he is named the Republican nominee for vice president. It's in San Francisco at the mansion of a tech tycoon named David Sacks. David Sacks has also contributed to Vance and his success. And ultimately, he's at this dinner, and Sacks and other tech investors appear to say, "We want Vance. He's our guy. He's who you should pick for vice president."
I think what's really interesting about this anecdote is there's another potential VP candidate in the room as well, this guy Doug Burgum, who is being talked about. And in the room with this guy, everyone is saying, pick JD, pick JD. And it shows how, key his ties are in Silicon Valley. David Sacks, the host of this event, is actually a former Peter Thiel colleague. They worked at PayPal together. There's a deep connection there as well. They wrote a book together. They attended Stanford together. You now have another kind of Thiel acolyte pushing JD Vance. And lo and behold, it worked.
So I have to ask, and this is a difficult question, is what has Peter Thiel bought here?
This is a guy who understands how power works and how the dynamics work at, the highest levels in Washington, in DC. And he has been able to place someone essentially right next to the presidency, which is kind of interesting given that he has sort of cooled on Donald Trump. He, at least as we know, has not given money this cycle
That
to
may
Donald
change
Trump.
now. We'll have to wait and see.
That may change. And he has spoken kind of half-heartedly about Trump. There was a appearance at a conference recently where he said, if you hold a gun to my head, I guess I'll vote for Trump over Biden. This was before the Kamala announcement or, Biden stepping down. But, it's not the stunning endorsement he gave in 2016, but that was also before Trump picked Vance. And so that kind of could change the calculation for someone like Peter Thiel.
And campaigns are, in large part about raising money. It allows you to go up on television, it allows you to hire staff and door knockers and all the kinds of things that you need to run a campaign. I want to talk a little bit about Elon Musk. So he has announced that he's going to contribute $45 million a month to a pro-Trump PAC. That is a mind-boggling amount of money. As somebody who is writing a book or about to publish a book on Elon Musk, how did he get, what is going on? That is, I mean, look, he is a very wealthy man. I'm sure he can afford this kind of investment, but that is still a massive investment in a political candidate.
So I'll actually push back on that a bit, which is we haven't been able to confirm the number, and
Okay.
that was something from the Wall Street Journal. He, in fact, has denied that he is going to give that amount
I
of
appreciate the
money.
context then, yeah.
I mean, it's quite odd though, because he has said publicly, and we have to really parse his words and what he says. He said he's founded a PAC, this PAC called the America PAC. He says he hasn't given any money to it, but it is odd to have a PAC and not have money. So he could get in the game, and I think he is. I think what should be said here is he has, with a full-throated endorsement, backed Donald Trump and JD Vance. He has made it very clear who he wants in this race, and the people around him are the ones that have donated money thus far. He, I think, is sort of biding his time. He kind of has showed his cards as well, but he is there, and he does have deep pockets to fund something like this.
What's interesting to me is you seem to have two groups of tech I don't know if I want to call them tech bros, but maybe that's the easiest way to say it. There are the ones that we see as more liberal, like Mark Zuckerberg, and then there's the ones that we see as more conservative, like Thiel and Elon Musk. And I mean, these are all very incredibly wealthy men. It's fascinating to me to see how they've gone for one candidate or another, because when we think about it, $45 million a month, whether it's true or not, they have the ability to change races, to change outcomes. I mean, Thiel is, I think it's safe to say he's a major reason why J.D. Vance is now the vice presidential nominee.
I think, yeah, regardless of how you look at it from either party. I mean, I think of someone like Reid Hoffman on the Democratic side, who's given, you know, tens of millions of dollars in this race to Democrats. You know, every time we look at stories like this, it shows how our political system is essentially captured by the wealthiest individuals in the country, you know, and not just in the country, but in a very small region in California, men that have made their wealth, you know, building internet companies or funding them. And I think that shouldn't be lost in all this. I mean, we're talking mind-numbing kind of numbers when it comes to these elections.
Do J.D. Vance and Musk know each other? Do they have much of a relationship? From your reporting, have you been able to tease that out?
We've been trying to tease it out. I mean, what we know is Elon has advocated for J.D. Vance, especially when Trump had not made his pick. You know, there was a lot of lobbying from the Musk side to Donald Trump to pick him. But in terms of like the Thielian kind of relationship that dates back to law school, as far as I understand, nothing like that.
The final question that I have is, you know, ultimately the big question will be, if there is a Trump-Vance administration, is what kind of tech policies they will and won't support. What do we know about what kind of tech policies they may push for? Obviously, Elon Musk aligns with Trump on the idea of liberal bias in social media, about not filtering, not restricting, quote unquote, access to whatever anybody wants to post.
There's a lot of conflicting views that are held, you know, in this campaign. I don't know. It's hard to say. So, for example, Trump gave a speech this weekend where he railed against EVs, but Elon Musk runs the largest EV company there is. So you're kind of wondering, well, why are you backing this guy? It doesn't really make sense. You know, but there are other reasons for his support. With J.D. Vance, what we know that he's articulated is he has actually been against big tech. And when I talk about big tech, there are certain companies he has gone after and suggested that we break up, you know, something like Google, for example. He has expressed a lot of negative sentiment towards Meta and its founder, Mark Zuckerberg. So you may see some action in that perspective. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is not the biggest, you know, doesn't have the biggest fan in Donald Trump either, you know. So there have been some reading of the tea leaves on how tech policy will go. But I think it remains to be seen because, you know, they have changed their minds this way and that when it comes to this kind of stuff.
That's Ryan Mack, a tech reporter for the New York Times. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, the CrowdStrike computer crash heard around the world. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our next topic is the blue screen of death, the colossal computer crash that took down everything from airlines and banks to hospitals and grocery stores last week. Wired's senior writer, Lily Hay Newman, has been covering the issue, and she's going to walk us through what the heck happened. Welcome to All Sides, Lily.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
This was not a cyber attack. This was not malware. This was a flawed software update. Can you explain what went wrong with CrowdStrike?
Yeah, so a platform like CrowdStrike's needs really deep access into your system in order to do the threat monitoring that it's doing all the time and catch potentially, you know, suspicious activity or things that are abnormal. But at the same time, that means that when they are doing updates or updating for the latest threats or, you know, doing updates to their platform, that same deep access can kind of backfire on them if there's any type of error or mistake and cause the type of crisis that we saw.
Widespread doesn't even begin to cover it. I mean, it wasn't just here in the U.S., but it was globally. Airlines, banks, hospitals, media operations were all disrupted, but it was essentially limited to Microsoft Windows users. What was it about Microsoft and this CrowdStrike issue that created such chaos?
It was just that this update was for Windows software. So Windows users were affected, Linux and Mac users were not.
And one of the things that I find really fascinating about this is there wasn't a fix that they could push out to everybody all at once. You actually had to have an IT guy come in and physically touch your computer to fix it, which is probably why it continues to linger.
That's exactly right. You had to physically get hands-on with the device because it was in this sort of bricked or unreachable state where you couldn't remotely access it and, you know, remotely press some buttons and fix it. You needed to be there with the device, boot it into safe mode, you know, apply the fix and restart.
Which does raise a question for me, and maybe it's my own ignorance showing, of how could it cause a problem remotely that had to be fixed physically? Like, if it could cause the issue, why couldn't it fix the issue?
Well, the reason the blue screen of death is a technical term or, so, you know, something everyone knows about is because it's kind of this like endless feedback loop or restart loop, a fail loop. That's a good way to describe it, where the system is just endlessly trying to do something it can't do and failing into that state. So then you can't do anything else with it at that point.
What has CrowdStrike's CEO, George Kurtz, had to say about this?
A lot of apologies.
That's a safe place to start.
Safe, necessary, you know, what else can you really say? And a lot of, you know, talking about just the trust the company has earned, that it is now compromised by this situation. And CrowdStrike has also said that, you know, as of early this week, sort of, I believe the quote is the majority of systems that were affected are back online. But to your point, you know, that took human people physically going to all of those computers to do that fix. And so that's why the long tail.
One of the questions this has raised is about consolidation, particularly in cybersecurity, that CrowdStrike is so ubiquitous that it caused such a massive failure. Are you continuing to hear conversations about why everybody, except for Southwest Airlines, weirdly, uses CrowdStrike?
Definitely. It indicated or sort of illustrated that, you know, they are a crucial player in the sector. But I think also it really shows the interconnectedness of the internet, of our digital systems, and those interdependencies. Because, you know, I've been talking to a lot of sources about how this is impacting them, and many of them, what they're really trying to emphasize is that their organization or their company wasn't a CrowdStrike user itself. and didn't have affected machines on their own network, but they work with third parties or other services that are providing crucial services to them, and those third parties were customers. So you can have disruptions and outages even if you're not directly affected, and that's because everybody's relying on each other.
And some of the stories were incredible, and you realize just how reliant we've become on this technology. You know, Indian Airlines had to issue handwritten boarding passes. Businesses could only like take cash. You saw people very angry in airports being told, "Look, we cannot book you on something else. We have no system to book you anywhere."
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people writing paper prescriptions, surgeries delayed, you know, and this can happen. We've seen these types of disruptions happen before, maybe like with cloud services where things go down. But like you were saying, this one was particularly notable, first of all, because it stemmed from this one sort of almost niche company in a way that then, you know, had these massive reverberations. And second, because it wasn't like as soon as the cloud service was back up, everyone was back up. This, you know, went on and on.
Yeah, one of the things I found really fascinating, one of the conversations that's emerging since the CrowdStrike crash, is that there is this push, particularly in cybersecurity, to get the latest update in and up and running as quickly as possible. That taking time to vet what they're sending makes you vulnerable to cyber attack. And I wonder if that's going to change going forward.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, that's where the tension is on this. On the one hand, in order to have the best defense, you need to be really nimble. You need to, you know, share information, push out updates quickly, you know, push out defense new defense tactics quickly. But on the other hand, because these systems need that deep access that I was talking about and, you know, deep control on systems, you can't just be pushing something out that is flawed or you know wrong or is going to have a deleterious effect. So finding the balance is really complicated, and definitely that's what everyone's looking at now is what do we need to learn from this?
You also wrote about scams that popped up quickly, which I guess that makes sense under the guise of CrowdStrike support, basically saying, "Hey, let us into your computer. We can fix this."
Yeah, and like you're saying, these days that always happens, that with any topical issue that there are going to be scams around it, anything that's in the news, anything that people are aware of. But again, not to harp on it, it's just kind of fascinating that in this case, one of the things the scams were really preying on was the desperation of, you know, IT staff, system administrators trying to fix this problem as quickly as possible. You know, you might be really tempted and become more gullible than you would usually be if someone is saying, we have a remote solution to solve your problem.
Particularly, yeah, if you're a small business and suddenly you've completely shut down.
Exactly. And a lot of small businesses may not even have dedicated IT staff. Like they may not have any expertise immediately available. And the person they usually call is busy dealing with someone else who's having the same problem. So then they get this email that's like, well, just, you know, put in your credit card details here and we'll send you this solution. It's very compelling.
We're obviously still, rebooting from what happened. But what are some early lessons? Like, what are people telling you needs to change because of this?
I think that the key thing is just trying to examine those interdependencies and trying to have sort of a census or like an understanding of what devices you have on your network and what is running what, so that you can very quickly zero in on what you need to fix as things happen. And then the other thing people are talking about more broadly and kind of related to that is the idea of crisis planning, you know, doing what people call tabletop exercises, where you're imagining that you're in a scenario, you know, where everything's falling apart. And then what are you going to do? What are the systems that are going to be in place and the procedures to act and deal with it? But the tough thing there is you have to take time to prepare your staff and train everybody in those procedures. And a lot of companies feel like they don't have the margins to pull people off their regular work and train them.
You know, one of the great ironies of this was I was following how Southwest Airlines wasn't impacted by this. And the joke online is that they were essentially saved by procrastination or thriftiness, that they had software that was 30 years old and that protected the company from the outage, which was kind of wild. They even joked on social media that they had like one server in Virginia running their program for the last 30 years, and that's why they were fine.
Yeah, I think, crazy flukes like that can come up. And sometimes you can have, sometimes it's known as like security through obscurity, or in this case, like, lack of vulnerability through laziness or something. But I've also heard of situations where like healthcare companies or hospitals, or like local governments, organizations like that were able to buy CrowdStrike at discounted pricing, through like government contracts and special assistance, and they don't have big budgets either, but they were just trying to do the right thing, and then they got burned just by coincidence.
Oh my goodness, that's unfortunate. That was Lily Hay Newman, a senior writer at Wired. Thank you so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Coming up, why tech on the cheap isn't always the best investment. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Dupes are all over the internet, from lookalike clothing to handbags to tech gadgets. If one designer makes something that looks cool, another is probably going to copy it. But what about the technology inside tech dupes? Do these cheap clones of pricier technology offer a real bargain? Can they ever be as good as the original? Managing editor for commerce at CNET, Russell Holly, is here to tell us why we might want to be wary of these so-called bargains. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So online discounters like Temu, Shein, AliExpress, they're very popular with shoppers, and so are the tags on TikTok like Temu fail. And so you guys decided, and I love this, decided to buy a whole bunch of stuff from Temu and try it all out and see how it works. Let's start with the $11 AirPods. How did those go?
They sound exactly like $11 earbuds, which is, kind of the point, right? Is that the look is the thing that that these companies were going for, not any of the like underlying technology. So if your goal is to look like you're wearing, something a little more expensive than you otherwise would have, then these are, kind of the thing that will fit the bill. Making clones of things like AirPods, not exactly a new concept. In fact, there have been scams on places like Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist and things like that, where you think you're buying real AirPods, and then it, you get them home and you set them up, and it turns out that it was just the packaging that, kind of looked like it. This is very much that. Temu doesn't do any kind of quality control or assurance or anything like that. It's really just a marketplace for stuff that can be bought either in bulk or, one at a time. And you're definitely not getting anywhere near AirPod quality with $11 AirPods. I know that that is a shock to a lot of people, but
yeah, your reviewer said that they sounded like phone calls, like music was underwater. People had trouble hearing them on the AirPods. They also weirdly shouted at you when they turned on and off.
Yeah. There's no volume control for the kind of mediocre assistant that is built into it. It is always at its maximum volume, and there's nothing you can do about that in the settings.
That sounds terrible and also unsettling.
It's not a great experience, and I hesitate to think what would happen if someone does what I do on a regular basis, which is accidentally fall asleep with your headphones in while listening to a story or something like that. I imagine that would be really alarming.
I bet. But they did try a dupe for the Dyson vacuum, and she seemed pretty happy with how it performed.
That's right. Dyson has a history of being very expensive pieces of hardware, and if you own a Dyson, then chances are you are one of the many people who would extol its virtues and say that it is absolutely worth the price. You couldn't imagine buying another vacuum. But the truth is that vacuum tech has gotten really, really good over the last couple of years, in part because a lot of Dyson's original patents have expired, and so a lot of other companies are able to start using some of the technologies that Dyson was using in its earlier versions of its vacuums. So for $75, you can get something that is pretty comparable to a Dyson, specifically from a couple of years ago. It's not going to be the same as a Dyson that you would buy today with some of the newer technology into it. But if you've owned a Dyson before and you're kind of dreading the cost of getting another one, you actually can get not just on Temu, but on Amazon, there are a couple of different options that are available now that are way below that hefty price tag and still deliver really great results.
And then the one that scared me the most was she bought a dupe for the Dyson Airwrap, and it is a $600 hairdryer. For those who don't know what the Dyson Airwrap is, it is a very expensive hairdryer. It has attachments. It'll like curl your hair, give you a blowout, do some other things. But I was terrified because I was like, is it going to burn her hair off? Is that what I'm going to be reading about?
Yeah, it's even if you've never used it before or seen one in person, the Dyson Airwrap, the one made by Dyson, is a little unusual looking as far as hair dryers go to begin with. It has a very unique design. You kind of know exactly what it is when you look at it. And one of the things that even the kind of well-tested and well-loved version, a common criticism of it is it just feels like the heating part is just way too close to your hair. Now, Dyson has a bunch of stuff in there to make it so that it's not doing you any harm. So yeah, it is a valid concern that this thing that is now putting a heating element essentially half an inch away from your hair, if that's not doing what it's supposed to be doing, then that is a bad day waiting to happen.
Yeah, I feel like $11 earbuds that scream at me are far less risky than something that lights my head on fire.
That is exactly right. Now, no fires were started during the making of this evaluation. It was absolutely not as good as the Dyson Airwrap, but it's another one of those things where if your goal is for something that looks like it's doing the part, it's actually not the worst thing you could buy for that price tag.
I do want to quickly touch on the difference between knockoffs and dupes because there is a lot of, particularly when it comes to handbags, which are not technology, there's a lot of fake clothing, fake designer handbags, but there are fake Apple products out there, products that say Apple that are not Apple. And we're kind of talking about something different. We're talking about lookalike products, not products that are intentionally made to replicate a real product.
Absolutely. So in each one of the examples that we tested, when you bought the thing, it never once claimed to be an Apple or a Dyson product. And when it showed up, it had their company's logo and branding and instructions on it, and in no way attempted to be an AirPod for you, the person buying it. But if you're walking down the street and you see somebody wearing them, there's no way you look at them and go, "Oh, those are knockoff AirPods." Like you're going to look at them and immediately think that person is wearing AirPods.
Yeah, and because it is illegal to sell counterfeit goods, just generally. I mean, there's tons of websites that do it, but it is absolutely legal. But I do want to ask about copyright infringement. You know, particularly Apple products, the Dyson vacuums have a distinct look. The Dyson hairdryer has a very distinct look. Are there legal challenges to dupes that have those same visual cues?
If they were manufactured and sold here in the United States, then absolutely. But outside of the United States, the rules are a little different, in particular in China, which is where Temu tends to do most of its business as far as sourcing manufacturers. And so you're not making a purchase on a US website. You are providing a US address for it to be shipped to. But that transaction is happening in a place where the rules are pretty murky. And this is the kind of thing that there have been several companies that have asked the US Trade Commissions to kind of step in on and crack down on in ways so that US citizens aren't purchasing things blindly and not understanding what it is that they've bought. But this is this really kind of lives in that murky area.
Let's shift and talk about Rufus. Amazon's new virtual shopper. Rufus had its rollout in the days before the company's annual Prime Day sale. So how did Rufus's debut go?
Yeah, so this is actually something that surprised a bunch of folks because Amazon didn't make a whole bunch of noise about it. Rufus just sort of appeared in your Amazon app. There was a set of colorful dots at the bottom of the screen where the menu button used to be. And if you tapped on it, then it would present you, if you've ever used AI chatbots before, with a very familiar kind of conversational style experience where you could make requests for a ton of different things. If you were looking for a specific kind of product, like I want a chopping board that's, you know, 6 inches wide or something like that, or a specific kind of genre of book, you know, you're not sure exactly what it is you're looking for and you're looking for recommendations, that's where this product is supposed to really shine. This is a replacement to what Amazon had been doing last year, which is actually working with a whole bunch of different publications all around the world to source recommendations from experts. Amazon decided last year to close that program down and replace it with this artificial intelligence. And it's not super great at recommending things, at least right now.
So Rufus had mixed reviews. Is that safe?
Mixed reviews is definitely a polite way of putting it. We noticed in a bunch of the examples that if you made a request for a specific book genre, that it would struggle to do things in kind of a sequential order. It would often recommend books like the second in the series first, and then the first in the series, and then the third in the series in order on the page, so that if you don't know any better, you're likely buying these books in the wrong order.
That's a big deal with like fantasy and other like genres that have multiple books in a series.
Absolutely, yeah. If you're you know, reading a book and you get halfway through and realize that, you know, this is super confusing because this is not the first book in the series, that is a terrible experience. If you were asking for, you know, specific kitchen appliances, it often had really thin recommendations compared to what would happen if you use that exact same search on Amazon. The overall experience, if you kind of know what you're looking for, you're better off using the actual Amazon search, whereas Rufus seems more for you're not totally sure what it is you're looking for, but you're looking for something maybe like a gift for a six-year-old or something like that. Then that is, you know, kind of generic enough that some of the recommendations might be useful. But the more specific you get, the less useful this tool is at the moment.
You had a reviewer who wanted suggestions for her puppy's birthday. What happened when they asked for that?
Yeah. So the specific request was for treats made with high quality ingredients. That is something that is, you know, kind of specific.
Yeah.
Keyword generated. You know, the kind of thing that you're kind of putting in that request to get to get a response. The first thing on the list was a birthday bandana and a dog kind of party package with a banner that said, "It's my B-Day, Mother Puppers." Which I can't help but point out is not a treat. It might be a treat for the person reading it, but it is. It did not really meet the request in general.
Although I can't get that out of my head. It's going to live like rent free in my head for a while now. But
I honestly may order that sign just to hang it behind me so that you have to see it every time.
You know. This all may be why Amazon did not make a big deal about Rufus, is that they're just kind of slowly trying to test it out.
That is absolutely the way that this was rolled out. It was done, you know, almost in secret and right before Amazon's Prime Day, so that it knew it would get a ton of different people using it all at once, thinking that it was the search tool when it wasn't. And that's, you know, we're seeing a fair bit of that across the board right now, where companies have made big announcements on artificial intelligence being added into their products, and it immediately does not work very well. And so they kind of roll it back a little bit. Amazon is one of several companies that are trying the reverse approach, where they just sort of slowly encourage people to use this thing and then use the feedback from it to make it better. But Amazon's, you know, shopping experience is one of those things that hasn't really changed much in quite a while. So when you add a very colorful button in a platform that is otherwise pretty black and white, it's going to stand out.
Samsung has a new watch. It's called the Galaxy Watch Ultra, and it's for Android users. So you had somebody test it for a couple weeks and ended up recommending a different watch. So what's going on there?
Samsung has been broadly, considered the company that makes smartwatches for Android phones. Like, it is the one that gets compared most often to iPhones. It works with almost every Android phone. The Samsung experience tries really hard to compete with Apple when it comes to offering kind of fitness features. And what you see with the Galaxy Watch Ultra is very much an effort to approach the Apple Watch Ultra, where it is a ruggedized case and it is, capable of operating for multiple days and has, kind of a reasonable low power mode. But, at the end of the day, these often get compared to the experience that you get with an iPhone or an Apple Watch, and that is not what you get with this. This is certainly an improvement. If you're looking for something that is, for someone like me who would go on, a Sentry ride and have a normal, Samsung watch, the battery not make it through, 9 hours of cycling or something like that. But if your goal is to just have a really nice, looking watch on your wrist, the recommendation from our team is actually the Galaxy Watch 6 Classic, which looks more like a traditional watch and is not immediately obvious that it's a smartwatch when you first look at it.
I will say one of the downsides of Apple watches is sometimes the battery life too. If you are a true like elite outdoor distance runner, long athlete, a lot of people just go with Garmin.
That's absolutely right. This is something that Apple tried to solve with its Apple Watch Ultra by putting just a giant battery in there and giving low power mode so that you could use it for multiple days. But one of the things that Apple is pretty quick to hide from folks is that your average Garmin fitness tracking watch will last multiple days before it needs to be charged just by default. Like, you don't have to tweak the settings or anything like that. Those are the watches that are preferred by fitness folks, even Olympic athletes, for a reason.
What is the price on the Galaxy Watch 7 versus the Classic 6?
So the Galaxy Watch Classic 6, as the name and numbering scheme might suggest, is going to be right around $650,
Oh my goodness.
and the Galaxy Watch Ultra is actually going to start out just a little tiny bit more expensive. You can get kind of the base version of it for a little over $700, and then there are a bunch of other accessories that you're going to want to add. So the cost is relatively similar. Because it's been out for a year, there are going to be a bunch of places where you can get the Classic 6 for less than that kind of standard retail price, especially when it comes to things like Black Friday and Cyber Monday, if you're planning on waiting a little while to upgrade your watch. But yeah, for the most part, you're definitely spending more than $500 for a watch like this.
Oh my goodness, that is more than some of the high-end garments.
That is absolutely more than some of the high-end Garmins. The argument there is that you're doing a whole lot more, including, kind of paying with your phone and things like that. It's not immediately clear how many folks do that, or if they just have the watch specifically for things like step tracking and fitness and stuff like that. You just don't see a ton of people pay for things with their watch, or, kind of, scan, read websites and do stuff like that. It's a little crazy the number of, just kind of raw features that are built into some of these watches compared to what most folks end up using them for.
We're almost out of time, but I did want to quickly talk about smart thermometers. So these work by telling your heating and air conditioning system to change the temperature. You had a reviewer test it, and he liked Amazon's smart thermostat the best. So do you just tell it, I like to live in this temperature, and then it just handles it for you? How is this working?
There's actually a couple different ways that you can do this. A lot of folks tend to prefer to give it a range of temperatures. So, throughout the course of the day, I would like the house to stay. I'm going to say numbers and understand that there are some really deep opinions when it comes to what the temperature of a house should be. So just bear with me. Usually someone will say, I want to keep the house between 68 and 72, to kind of exist in that range. That way, when you are asleep, you don't have to worry about the thermostat kicking on and keeping the house super cool while you are asleep, and it can save power in that way. And also, when the sun is, kind of at its highest, you can have the thermostat kind of kick on automatically. There are a bunch of kind of smarter things that this is capable of, including knowing when you have left the house so that it's not actively keeping the house cool when there's nobody there. This includes, kind of using motion detecting sensors. So if it hasn't seen anybody walk by in, say, an hour or two, then it'll, kind of turn down or turn up the thermostat a little bit, depending on, kind of where you are. But really, the goal there is to just make it so that You're not thinking about where your thermostat is set. You know, you can have it set before you go home or anything like that. And that is something that for $80 is way better than what you're going to get from a lot of other $200 and $300 thermostats.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a lot more sophisticated than a programmable thermostat, which is what a lot of builder basic houses come with.
Yeah, this is definitely the kind of thing that you would use to replace that like standard thermostat that you would find in a house for not a lot of money, and you're actually getting a fair bit out of the experience.
And that is substantially cheaper than Nest and some of the more fancy, more stylized smart thermostats.
Sometimes you'll see Google's thermostat, the Google Home E specifically, will go on sale for quite a bit less than that like $200 price point. But yeah, for the most part, these kind of higher end thermostats, the thing that they add is the ability to have multiple thermostats in multiple rooms. So if you have a bedroom that gets particularly hot, for example, then you can put a different thermometer in there
Oh.
that will talk to that thermostat and let it know that, you know, this part of the house isn't at the temperature that you want it to be. But otherwise, you know, if you've got a smaller place or an apartment or something like that, you're not going to use that function much anyway. So it's a good compromise.
That was Russell Holly, managing editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you as always.